Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another session of the Vancouver Institute. Undoubtedly one of the most distinguished town and gown social activities on the North American continent. Let me remind you of some of our forthcoming lectures and lecturers. Next week, October 31st, Professor Marketa Getz-Stankiewicz will speak on the Czech theater, a subject on which she is a very distinguished authority. Her lecture will be followed for the members of the Vancouver Institute with a reception in the faculty club to which all members are invited. On November the 7th, Dr. Martin Hoffman of the Faculty of Medicine at this university will speak on Understanding Diabetes, What Everyone Should Know. On November the 14th, Professor John B. Crispo of the University of Toronto, now visiting at Simon Fraser, will speak on Industrial Relations, Mandate for Canada. On November 21st, Professor Charles F. Doran, the director of the Center of Canadian Studies at Johns Hopkins University, will speak to us on Canadian-American relations under the Reagan administration. And our last lecture will be by Professor Thomas K. Shoyama on November 28th on Canada's economy, prospect, and policy. Now, in reading out the list of our future lecturers for this term, you will note that, regrettably, one of our original lecturers, Professor Czesław Milos, the Polish Nobel laureate, originally scheduled to speak to us on November 21st, for a variety of reasons, is unable to meet the commitment on that date, but will speak to us on a later occasion, we trust, in the following year. However, as you also noted, we have an impressive replacement on a timely topic, Canadian-American relations under the Reagan administration. Now, one of my regrettable tasks as president of the Institute is to do my best to keep the Institute solvent. Hence my weekly attempts to lighten your pocketbook in a good cause. The membership rates, as you know, are trivial, insignificant. In fact, they're so low, some individuals thought they only referred to admission to one Saturday evening. But in fact, these rates of $2 for a student, $10 for a single member, and $15 for a family membership apply not just to one Saturday evening or even one session, one term, but to the whole Vancouver Institute year. They are available to you outside the door as you leave. Given my Scottish background, my appeal for funds, I must admit, creates somewhat of a personal dilemma for me. On the one hand, I am impressed with the fact that our lectures are free. And as a good Scot, I applaud you for cannily taking advantage of a free Saturday night on the town. On the other hand, we need the money. And freedom, in short, here as elsewhere, has its price. So the only way, regrettably, that our tradition of free lectures can be maintained is by having you pay money by joining at the nominal fees already mentioned. Now, our speaker this evening, Dr. Connor Cruz O'Brien, has had a most distinguished career, which goes on, seemingly, from triumph to triumph and shows no sign of cessation. He was educated at Trinity College Dublin for his BA and PhD. He entered the Department of Foreign Affairs of Ireland in 1944, which included a period at the United Nations from 1956 to 60, culminating in the position of representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations in the Katanga for 8 months in 1961. At this point, Dr. O'Brien left the United Nations and the Irish Foreign Service and embarked on a succession of distinguished university appointments accompanied by many, many honors. He was Vice Chancellor of the University of Ghana from 1962 to 65 and Albert Schweitzer Professor of Humanities at New York University from 1965 to 1969. In the midst of this period, Dr. O'Brien became a Member of Parliament in the Republic of Ireland from 1969 to 77 and Minister of Communications from 1973 to 77. Incredibly, he has also found the time to be a prolific writer of books, more than a dozen at last count, indeed a very, very generous baker's dozen. In fact, the latest copy of the New York Review of Books, which just arrived on my doorstep, has his name prominently featured on the front page, indicating an important article on South Africa, which he has written for that journal. He was recently editor-in-chief of the Weekly British Observer from 1978 to 81 and is now the consultant editor for that very eminent British newspaper. As one surveys his career, the suspicion, I must admit, emerges that Dr. O'Brien has a somewhat flighty character, manifested in difficulty in holding down a job. The Vancouver Institute, wishing to keep up the quality of its speakers, made discreet inquiries, and we have been assured that this is definitely not the case. Dr. O'Brien is simply a Renaissance man. May I remind you, it was much easier to be a Renaissance man in the Renaissance than now. This evening, Dr. O'Brien will speak to us on the subject, the press and the world. Dr. Connor Cruz O'Brien.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Our chairman just now was very kind in saying that I'm not really a chap who has difficulty in holding down a job, but that I'm a Renaissance man. Well, I can think of quite a few Renaissance men who had difficulty in holding down a job, and one of them was Machiavelli. So I can claim to be in good descent in either interpretation of my career. Seriously, I'm very honored to be your guest speaker and to attend this extraordinarily large, distinguished gathering to be talking to you here this evening. I come from Dublin, and I must say, you couldn't get an audience this size in a lecture hall in Dublin on a Saturday night. They are all elsewhere. By the way, can I be clearly heard in the back? Okay, that's great. Then I can carry on. In the Cancun summit just ended, the representatives of rich and poor countries have been discussing problems associated with what is often called the need for a new international economic order. Representatives of the poor countries also call for the institution of a new international information order. That demand, the situations that give rise to it, and the proper response to it form a large part of my subject matter here tonight. The demand for a new international information order has been voiced mainly through UNESCO and through its Committee on Information, which is chaired by my distinguished and versatile fellow countryman, Mr. Sean McBride. Distinguished and versatile, by the way, are linked epithets. For Mr. McBride's versatility, which is even greater than my own, is reflected in the range of his distinctions, which are much greater than mine. He is the holder of the Nobel Peace Prize and of the Lenin Peace Prize. He is also a former chief of staff of the IRA. Match that if you can. And this accomplished and charming gentleman, and he is, as they seriously is also the head of this curious campaign for the international regulation of the press and media. I believe that we in the Western world have a considerably better press than any that exists elsewhere in the world. That, of course, is not saying a very great deal. Ours is a press with many and great, and as I fear, growing defects, but it cannot benefit from remedies proposed on behalf of countries where governments control their own press and broadcasting and would like to control, and that is what this is about, what is reported about them in the press and broadcasting of other countries. That much is clear, and should, I believe, be politely but firmly reiterated on behalf of the West on all appropriate occasions. Yet, without accepting the proposed remedies, we should realize that the case made in the name of the poorer countries about an imbalance between rich and poor in relation to the world flow of news and commentary does contain much that is in itself valid, whatever our reservations about motives and our proper resistance to certain suggested remedies. There is one other matter which will take me somewhat further afield in the closing part of my remarks. Today, as I think most of you will know, happens to be United Nations Day, the 36th anniversary of the UN's foundation. While I deplore the intrusion of a member of the UN family, UNESCO, into one area which I feel unsuited to it, I should not like, especially on this day, to leave you with a merely negative impression of UN activity. I propose, therefore, to devote the end of my lecture to the subject of the United Nations and peace, with the contention that the UN's role is of crucial importance for our survival and is seriously underestimated and misunderstood by our press and media and by public opinion generally. That will also have the advantage of widening the scope of inquiry here this evening and so encouraging wider participation in our question time period, often the most valuable part of an occasion like this. For the moment, back to the new international information order. Now, the press that does most to shape humanity's view of its predicament and possibilities is the press of the advanced countries, the rich world, a section of the world which contains a minority of the world's population and consumes most of the world's resources. The press and related media determine, under certain constraints, to which I shall come later, what most people in the advanced world know about the poorer world, including both the communist and non-communist states. Less obviously, these media also determine, to a great extent, what people in the poorer countries know about other poor countries, including neighboring countries. And also, and this can be a very sore point indeed, to some extent, what people in a given poor country know about what happens in their own country. There may be something their government doesn't want them to know, and they may hear it on their transistor from an outside broadcasting source, almost always from the West. The reason why the media in the advanced countries have this power are clear enough. They dispose, first of all, of a more far-reaching and extensive network of news gathering than anyone else. They dispose of a more extensive apparatus of news diffusion, and related to that, the diffusion of entertainment than anyone else. But they possess also, in relation to news, a more precious asset, reliability. Partly that is because, again, they can pay for it. Reliability is costly because it involves the expenditure of much time by skilled and therefore highly paid personnel. The poor in this world of ours can't afford reliability, or rather they can't afford to create reliability. If they are to get it at all, they must get it secondhand, either through the great Western news agencies, set up primarily to meet the needs of the advanced countries, or through the broadcasting systems, mainly sound radio, of these same advanced countries. Those are the simplicities of the thing, and brutal enough they are. But there is also a more subtle and intangible and curious factor. There are countries which can afford reliability in diffusion of information, but simply don't want it. Saudi Arabia is one example of such a country. But it is a characteristic of our Western bourgeois societies that they not only can afford reliability in the diffusion of information, but also want it, indeed crave for it. This thirst for the diffusion of reliable information is a unique characteristic of bourgeois society. The kings and the nobles did not care for that kind of thing. The communist countries do not care for it today, nor do most of the various rulers of the Third World. This is a special taste, a bourgeois taste. Throughout this lecture, I will be affirming things which some of you may wish to challenge, and of course, I'll be very happy that you should do that in the form of questions at the end. The state of things I have described has given rise to considerable dissatisfaction in the poorer countries. The extent of the dissatisfaction of the people of these countries is generally not at present measurable. The dissatisfaction of the rulers of these countries is measurable and reflected in many statements at UNESCO and the UN, which are, of course, and we should always remember this, intergovernmental associations rather than international associations in any broader sense. The rulers of these countries are not, in most cases, chosen by the inhabitants, and the interests of the rulers and the inhabitants are not necessarily the same. This is something to be wary of. Many references in the press and elsewhere to third world countries and their alleged views assume an identity of interest between rulers and ruled. In many cases, that identity is, to say the least, open to question. It is really astonishing, however, in how many cases, and above all in what quarters, such an identity is simply assumed as uncontestable. Take, for example, the following from a contribution to a 1978 study commissioned by the International Press Institute. It's called UNESCO and the Third World Media, an Appraisal. And I quote, "A common belief in many quarters is that government control or ownership of the press handicaps it." It is the press, not the government. "This is more often the view of people outside a country which has a government-owned press than those inside such countries." I'm still quoting, by the way. I want that to be very clearly understood. "But in any event, whether government ownership is a good thing or a bad thing is a decision to be taken by a country itself and is thus outside the scope of any discussions on how to strengthen the press in the third world. After all, the true mass media of the third world is the radio, and in virtually every instance, this is owned by the government." Close the quotation from the International Press Institute. Notice, first of all, the phrase, "more often the view of people outside a country which has a government-owned press than those inside such countries." How does the writer know that? How can he know how often, how many people inside such countries like having a government-controlled press and radio, and how many just shut up about something they dislike because it's not safe to complain about it? Does it occur to him that people under such conditions may be mortally afraid of their own government, as they are in many parts of the world? He writes as if such a thought had never crossed his mind. Blandly, he asserts, "whether government ownership is a good thing or a bad thing is a decision to be taken by a country itself." By a country itself. In a country which is not a democracy, how can a decision be taken by a country? In which of the countries which have government ownership of the press have the people of the country ever been consulted about the matter? What the phrase really means, I'm afraid, is whether government ownership is a good thing or a bad thing is a decision to be taken by a government itself. As far as the third world is concerned, that is. The writer of that, a Westerner, a Democrat, and a friend of the free press, Frank Barton, former African director of IPI, goes on a little later in the same essay, entitled "Strengthening the Press in the Third World," to give an example, for which I'm grateful in a way, of his own efforts in that direction. He is speaking of those cases in which, to use his own language, and I quote again, quote, "the media feels, sick, obliged to protect the image of the leader of the new government to an extent which is arguably excessive." I like arguably. more arguably here than there. In any case, the writer goes on, speaking of some of these same more or less arguable excesses, and I quote again, quote, "Two examples from scores of such cases are the national dailies of Uganda and Malawi. In the former state, it is not uncommon," this is 1978, you will recall, "in the former state, that is Uganda, it is not uncommon for a dozen pictures of President Idi Amin to be carried in any one issue. And in the latter state, it is considered that a photograph of President Hastings Banda should be used in each issue. IPI's Africa director," that is the author of this stuff, "who was asked to give his views on both publications, suggested," and now here is the solemn suggestion of the International Press Institute, the international body representative of the world's press. He suggested that in the former case, it might be more effective if fewer pictures of the president, but more carefully displayed, were used. And in the latter case, that a series of stock shots, but all different, should be used rather than repeating the same picture over and over again." Unquote. Again, it clearly does not occur to this unfortunate man that all he was doing was helping dictators to improve their techniques of brainwashing their subjects. That difficulty simply doesn't present itself once you speak of a dictatorship as a country, thus obliterating the distinction between the dictator and his subjects, the latter being deemed to agree with the former, since they are both part of the one thing. So you see the slippery slope you get onto if you start using the word country to mean the government of the country. The IPI is a greatly respected body, very sensitive about press freedom in countries which do enjoy some of that, and it is strange, and I think significant, that statements of this kind should be published under its auspices and by its former Africa director. What it is significant of, I think, is the forms of moral and intellectual ambiguity that often prevail in those areas where a free press and a government-controlled press come into cooperative contact, as they do in the various UNESCO forums. It seems to me, on the whole, that the technical improvement of the products of a government-controlled press is not a matter to which representatives of a free or competitive press should be required to devote their energy. Surely the people who best need and deserve that help are people who are trying to run a free press in those gray area countries of the world where a free press exists, but precariously. And I know from experience, some of it experience at the IPI congresses, that those people, the gray area people, trying to run decent newspapers in conditions of some danger in countries where the press has some freedom and dangerous limitations also, these are the people who most object to the kind of activity I'm talking about here, the efforts at international regulation of the press. They know what it means. The dictators and dictator parties can themselves afford to hire people to solve such problems as how often the pictures of the dictator or president shall be used and how carefully they should be displayed. Very carefully is what I should advise myself if asked. However, I think it is not in doubt that news, straight news, should be made available by the international news agencies to any press that wants it, even if it is fairly certain that some of it will be doctored afterwards by some of that press. The flow of news in the world goes, as has been said, vertically from the more advanced countries to the poorer ones. There is concern, and there are both legitimate and illegitimate grounds for concern, about this flow of news in the world. Let us therefore look a little more closely now at that matter. Broadly speaking, the flow of news in the world, I'm speaking of the whole world, is determined by two kinds of power. The first kind is political power, the power of a state or ruling party to control the flow of news and determine what it is considered to be in the public interest to allow to be published. This kind of political power is at its maximum in the communist countries, and in many, though certainly not all, countries of the Third World. This form of power is at its minimum in the advanced countries with a free enterprise or capitalist system. Even in these countries, of course, the pressure of political power, while far less than that obtaining in countries of the first type, is not non-existent. Most often it takes the form of limitations, of which the working of the British Official Secrets Act is a conspicuous and, to journalists, an onerous example. In the Western countries, on the other hand, there is another power which does dominate the totality of all that is published. This second kind of power is purchasing power, the power to buy copies of newspapers, to pay license fees. In its primary form, this purchasing power is also consumer power, the power to buy copies of newspapers, to pay license fees, to buy goods whose sellers can and do buy advertising space. This power, mighty in free enterprise conditions, not only determines what is published, but determines that a great variety of things may be published, suited to the tastes and interests of a wide variety of publics. The things published will include much that is frivolous and sensational, since there are many consumers who want those things. They also include much that is serious, instructive, and sophisticated, because there is a consumer market for these things too, and because the purchasing power of consumers with these interests compensates in the eyes of advertisers for their relative numerical weakness. These conditions as a whole, with all their imperfections, of which I'll have more to say in a moment, are, in my opinion, the best the press and its readers have ever known and the best they know today, however philosophically and in other ways inadequate they may be. The interplay of political democracy and the journalism of free choice produces paradoxical and often unedifying effects. These are the results of free play of human preferences, of the same people choosing whom they want to represent them and what they want to read, including what they want to read about those whom they choose to represent them. Of this whole system, it may be said with even more truth than of one product of the system, the British News of the World, all human life is there. The expressions of human freedom are disconcerting because human nature is disconcerting. The only way of making human nature look entirely respectable is to restrict its expressions severely by government edict. The expressions of freedom are less respectable but more interesting. They cannot be anything else because the most certain thing that can be said about free human beings is that they will not allow themselves to be bored, though that's a rather dangerous reflection to make when one is in the middle of a rather long lecture, I must say. The expression, the free press, is therefore a somewhat misleading one. Newspapers in these conditions are commodities, and their variety reflects the variety of the market. It's also true that newspapers are commodities in another sense, business concerns whose ownership may be acquired by purchase. The value of what is so acquired depends on how many people, having how much money, are prepared to buy individual copies of the paper. That is why I referred to consumer power as primary. So it is. But that is not to underestimate the importance of newspaper ownership or the gravity of the questions connected with it. We are accustomed to speak of our press as free. As I suggested, that's a rather misleading description. Our press is indeed free from government control. That is certainly a fact of fundamental importance. It can perhaps be fully appreciated only by people who have lived, as I have, in countries where the government does control the press. But in other senses, our press is not free. Newspapers are commodities in a double sense, as I've suggested, subject to the power both of the consumer and of the owner, powers which may be in some degree of tension. I shall come back to that in a moment. We also like to call our type of press competitive. That too, unfortunately, is a bit of an exaggeration, as I think you know in Canada. Our kind of press developed out of competition over the last two centuries or so. But the trouble with competitions, as George Orwell remarked, is that somebody wins them. Our competitive press, and this is true throughout the Western world, has been getting less competitive. Nationally, it is true that the press of the Western countries still presents a good deal of variety. But large communities which formerly possessed a vigorously competitive local press are often now reduced to one morning paper and one evening, sometimes, though not always, under the same ownership. In a compact, densely populated country like Britain, that may not matter so much. If the locally printed rag doesn't suit you, you can take your pick among nine competing national dailies, meeting an extremely wide range of tastes, and with a regional edition available when you want it. In a vast, thinly populated country like Canada, however, the restriction of a reader's freedom of choice is real and disquieting. But even in Britain, events of this year have been of a nature to dispel any complacency we might feel about the kinds of freedom the marketplace permits. As I mentioned, the range of the British press is extremely wide, vertically. At the top, you have some of the best newspapers in the world. I won't mention The Observer here, but they include The Times and The Sunday Times. At the bottom, you have the world's worst newspapers, The Sun and The News of the World. And early this year, my friends, The Times and The Sunday Times, the best, were both acquired by the owner of The Sun and The News of the World, the worst, Mr. Rupert Murdoch, the prince of soft porn. At the time, and I was younger then, it was earlier this year, at the time, I wrote about that transaction in The Observer in somewhat lofty terms, for which fate was to punish me with quite astonishing speed. The staff of The Times, you see, had bowed to the inevitable, seeing that the alternative to Mr. Murdoch looked like being closure of the two papers. About this, I wrote blithely, not to say impertinently, in The Observer at the time as follows, and I quote, "To say that Mr. Rupert Murdoch is not a fate worse than death is a bit of an insult to death." Yes, indeed. I thought it was very funny too, my friends. Yet, hardly was the ink dry on those words when Mr. Robert O. Anderson, the apparently philanthropic chairman of Atlantic Richfield and owner of The Observer, sold our paper without consulting even its board of directors, let alone its staff. He sold it like a bunch of bananas. He sold it to Mr. Tiny Rowland. Now, Mr. Rowland is not indeed a soft porn merchant. He is a kind of picturesque international buccaneer in the rigging of whose schooner your lecturer of this evening finds himself at present somewhat insecurely perched, thinking occasionally about our chairman's theme about holding down a job. Did I say something then about a fate worse than death? Ah, well. The funny thing is, however, that the editorial standards of the three papers concerned, Times, Sunday Times, and Observer, have so far, and of course none of this is very long ago, so far continued to be excellent. The reason for that is that if the new owners should be seen to monkey with those standards by any blatant intervention in editorial matters, such as firing me, The papers would, I think, lose readers, and therefore advertisers, and the new owners would therefore lose money, which must not be. That is not necessarily a watertight safeguard, but it is by far the best that exists, and infinitely better than the existing legal safeguards, which failed totally on these occasions. Neither the real virtues of the Western press system nor its real problems enter much, however, into the preoccupations of its third world critics, who are really most concerned with its sheer mass, wealth, resources, influence, and perhaps especially attractiveness. The existence and concentration and demands of news-consuming power in Western-type countries, a power always associated with entertainment, and entertainment and news do go hand in hand, have certainly a strong influence, a sort of gravitational pull, on the flow of news in the world, and it is natural that that influence should be questioned and challenged by some people living in third world countries. The pressures towards trivialization in a free press are real and pervasive, and they do affect coverage of third world events as of other events. True, these pressures can be resisted, and they often and honorably are. But the person who resists them does so at his peril, and in any case, the pressures return, persist, and will not go away. They are inherent in the nature and conditions of existence of what we call a free press, that is, a free market press. Some commentators in the third world and elsewhere, noting and deploring this fact, have concluded with puritanical logic that free choice ought to be abolished altogether throughout the world and state control substituted. Thus, a meeting of UNESCO communications experts, meeting at Bogota in July 1974, because all this has been going on for a good many years, declared, and I quote, "The formulation and execution of a national communications policy should be the exclusive concern of the state. Commercially owned media," and continuing the quotation, "by providing the people with amusement and means of escaping from reality, which tend to deaden their critical faculties and stultify their potential for action to bring about social change, fail to promote development." That statement is, I think, unwittingly a salutary reminder of the inseparability of entertainment from freedom of choice and of both from democracy. What would be protected from trivialization under the system of state control desired by the United Nations experts would not, of course, be truth. It would be the rulers and controllers, as usual. This system would impose a state version of truth, a monotonous official lie. The people would neither be informed nor entertained. They would be bored, but incurably so, by a state monopoly over which their boredom would exert no sway. In theory, some halfway house between state-controlled media and the free choice represented by different commercially owned media is conceivable and has been discussed. But in practice, I believe that this is not possible under political democracy. I may be wrong, but it's what I believe. Recently, when I discussed such ideas in Britain at a regional conference of headmasters, considerable abhorrence was understandably expressed of the standards of the mass circulation press there and their influence on the young. The idea was put forward that Parliament should, in effect, enact stringent legislation obliging the press to maintain much higher standards and entailing the disappearance of the sensational press of today. But of course, no democratic government would dare to initiate legislation involving the disappearance of such papers as The Sun and The News of the World in Britain. Those who love these papers have votes, lots and lots of votes. Action of that kind could be taken only by a government which would never have to face an election. Democracy and newspapers like these are inseparably connected as long as people want to read newspapers like these. Nor can the quality press be sharply separated from the mass circulation press in relation to the challenge made explicit in Bogota. The principle of freedom of choice is as vital to one kind of press as to the other. That freedom, as far as the quality press is concerned, limits the depth of its expression of commitment to truth, but it is not intrinsically hostile to such commitment, and in part welcomes it. For the quality press, it can never be a question of dropping either the role of entertainer or those of interpreter and informer. It is a question of distinguishing between what is proper to these roles and of preventing the contamination of the later roles by the inappropriate infiltration of the former. Truth and freedom of choice are not quite friends, nor quite enemies. As Gorky wrote about Tolstoy and God, they maintain suspicious relations, like two bears in one den. But truth and despotism are bears that cannot share one den at all. The high proportion of the flow of world news which is carried through Western news agencies and on Western radio and television is mainly determined, and this should be frankly acknowledged, by the interests of the cash customers in the advanced world. News is defined or defines itself as that which interests these people. Many of these people are not much interested in the third world at all. Many are most interested in sensational or gruesome news or scandalous news, whether from the third world or from elsewhere. And almost all of these readers are more avid for news from the advanced world than they are for news from the poor countries. And that, unfortunately, applies also to the people in the poor countries. They're more interested in news from the advanced countries, too. All these factors do influence the flow of news, although the extent of the influence of some of them is often exaggerated. But there is a certain core of reality in the charge that the news service which reaches the third world from Western channels is a kind of cast-off, a garment of information designed for someone else, someone fatter. Or rather, and these next aspects are generally less stressed at UNESCO debates, the flow of news reaching third world countries, other than countries themselves possessing an open press of Western type, consists of that Western byproduct, minus whatever the local regime finds it feasible and opportune to filter out, plus the propaganda output of that regime itself, and plus also the propaganda output of other countries whose output is approved by the local regime. And after all that, what remains of that Western byproduct, even though designed mainly for other people, remains the most informative as well as the most entertaining ingredient in that package. Only insofar as the distribution of wealth and of freedom of choice, consumer freedom, in the world shifts, can we expect to see a radical shift in the flow of news. Efforts through UNESCO and otherwise to change this system radically by a conglomerate intrusion of political power will always be met by firm resistance from Western-type countries and will therefore largely fail to give the desired results. Nor, I believe, has the pooling of news products of countries whose news is under state control, like the Tanjug pool, in any way matched the expectations which the sponsors of this system sought to arouse. One line leading towards improvement in the flow of world news as handled by Western agencies will have to come from the growth of consciousness in the Western public that the course of events in the third world, and in particular progress or lack of progress in development there, has to be a matter of great concern, not just to the third world, but to the West also, as it will do much to determine the character of the world in which children in the West will grow up. If Western interest in these matters can be increased, and the most responsible newspapers throughout the West are trying to increase it, then the value to the third world of what I have called the Western byproduct will automatically increase also. We may hope that the meeting just ended at Cancun will prove, in retrospect, to have been a significant stepping stone in that direction. Prime Minister Trudeau, as co-chairman of the conference, believes that this is the case, and I earnestly hope he may be right. There are a few elemental things that concern all humanity, things like the need for food and shelter and for peace. There are other things that are peculiar outgrowths of are not. It's a good, sound principle that people shouldn't try to regulate things that they know nothing about, and people who run government-controlled presses know nothing about what a free press is or can be. I have discussed one of the peculiar things. I should now like, in these concluding part of my remarks, to turn to an elementary thing, the effort to avoid a Third World War and the part that the United Nations can play in that. The preamble of the United Nations asserts as the primary object of the organization to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime, and this was 1945, has brought untold suffering to mankind. There can hardly be a greater objective than that. Many people, of course, think, without going into it very deeply, that the United Nations has in some way failed, that it has not worked. I think that's a superficial view. It has been produced, however, very understandably, by two things: the extraordinarily high hopes about the United Nations, which were encouraged in the period of its foundation and in its early years, up to the early 60s on the whole, and the fact that these expectations of a world to be run and transformed by the United Nations were inevitably disappointed. The world remains a world, and you will see, if you look closely at the charter that the founders so intended, the world remains a world of sovereign and independent states, and the United Nations remains an association of such states, and no more. But that does not mean that the United Nations is without utility. The United Nations has a function which has worked out in practice, and that function is one of making our survival marginally more likely, of helping to find ways of preventing local conflicts from escalating to regional ones from escalating to the unthinkable, to the Third World War. And I'd like to offer you now, here at the end, a respectful but pragmatic and non-starry-eyed assessment of the kind of things the UN does and can be expected to do, how it really works. The United Nations disposes of four main sets of resources for helping humanity to let itself survive. These resources are unacknowledged, and some of them are strange, but they have been tested in action and successfully. They are, these four resources: one, gaining time. This is in a situation which threatens to bring about world war. Gaining time. Second, letting off steam. Third, provision of a meeting place and of skilled intermediaries And fourth, and not least important, saving of faces of rulers, helping rulers to preserve face while climbing down. Absolutely vital, that last one, in my opinion, and often unappreciated, unnoticed. Gaining time is obvious. When powers are getting near the edge of conflict, they are both obliged by the charter, which might not matter much, and also will be, if sane, inclined to take the thing to the UN and argue about it there while they're preparing for war, but yet seeing whether something can be done. Time is gained, and each side knows that time can be gained. The second one, letting off steam. Well, when the powers concerned go to the United Nations, they can then blackguard one another to their heart's content before the General Assembly and have all that reported in their home press and media copiously and greatly to their apparent advantage. And that does help to cool things. It also, of course, all that steam helps to cloud things and in some cases rather to disgust people with the United Nations. Here is this supposedly Pacific thing, and all that seems to be happening is people cursing each other before the cameras. It's not edifying, but it has that function. Because while that, if you like, ritual incantation and cursing is going on the public stage, and the UN is very much a stage at the General Assembly, while that's going on, the third function is working. That is to say, the powers concerned are being brought together in one way or another by skilled intermediaries behind the scenes who are trying to find out politically satisfactory means of avoiding a contest. The skilled intermediary's duty is to find out which of them most wants to avoid this and what is the minimum that he has to get to make it politically possible for him at home to avoid it. And the fourth, of course, the saving of the faces of rulers, as I suggest, most important of all. And I think if that panoply of resources, including the last, had been available in 1914, it might have been possible to avoid a general world war, which almost nobody wanted. The Second World War, which was a consequence of the First, could not have been avoided in this way, but the First might. I spoke of tested and of these things being tested. I'd just like to give two illustrations of the testing. They're both a bit bizarre, but peace preservation, or I prefer the phrase war dodging, because it does suggest the improvised and precarious nature of the whole thing. It does take very strange forms. The first, the two examples I'll take, I could take a lot more, but I have to watch that boredom principle I drew attention to earlier myself very dangerously. And we're near the end. I'll just take two examples and give you them very briefly, how they worked. One was Suez 25 years ago, and the second was the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Many of you are too young to remember Suez, but what had happened there was that, in a nutshell, was that Britain and France, in collusion with Israel, had gone in, sent their forces in, with the object of toppling Nasser, who had nationalized the Suez Canal Company. They didn't want to say that their objective was to topple Nasser. At least the French wouldn't have much minded, and the Israelis didn't care at all. But Britain, which likes to behave with as much public decorum as possible, wanted to put a good face on things. So they announced that what they were doing was, Britain and France, was separating the combatants. They were, Israel had attacked Egypt, And here were these virtuous powers going in to separate these contending armies. For this purpose, landing 40 miles behind one of them. Then they found, for reasons that had nothing to do with the UN, that this thing wouldn't wash. It was an act, of course, of gross folly. They were being threatened by the Russians with rockets and things. That mightn't have mattered so much, but the United States was saying that they wouldn't put up with it, and a run on the pound had started, and Britain had to try to get out. But how to get out? I remember hearing Mr. Selwyn Lloyd, then Foreign Minister, standing at the podium of the UN, which is remarkably like this little podium I have here, and he was explaining to the UN how very, very difficult it would be for Britain to withdraw from Egypt. And an Iraqi delegate took the stand immediately after him, and he drew Mr. Lloyd's attention to an Arab proverb, which runs, "He who takes a donkey to the top of a minaret ought also to know how to get it down." So, where the UN comes in handy is getting donkeys down from the tops of minarets. It's a very good description of its activity. And actually, the man who had really the bright idea here was your then Prime Minister, one of the most enlightened and most agreeable statesmen of our time, Lester Pearson. And he had a sense of humor as well as of other things, and therefore was good at thinking how to extricate donkeys from difficult positions. And what he suggested was that the United Nations should take seriously Britain's claim that they had gone in to separate the combatants. Right, great, very good idea, separating the combatants, entirely in the spirit of the United Nations. So what will we do? We, United Nations, we will send in a force, the United Nations Expeditionary Force, which will do the job you set out to do and relieve you of that task. All this was worked out behind the scenes before it was publicly proposed. And poor Anthony Eden saw it as a good way of getting off the hook with as much face as he was entitled to, or a bit more by that time. So Britain announced that now that the United Nations had faced up to its duties and was going to separate the combatants, Britain would, of course, withdraw, that being all they had gone in for in the first place. So a little token force was sent over there to Egypt. And actually, that force could have continued to preserve the peace by its symbolic presence if NASA had not had the crazy idea in 1967 of ordering the force out because he was pretending to be straining at the leash to fight the Israelis, who then, much to his horror, fought him. And that particular war and an escalation there following a treatment of the United Nations which was unwise. That was the Suez one. There are other examples, rather more complex, which I don't have time for. But the Cuban Missile Crisis, the most dangerous crisis through which humanity has passed since the invention of thermonuclear weapons, the crisis of 1962, that's a relatively simple one. What was happening, many of you will recall, was the Soviet vessels were bound for Cuba, sailing across the Atlantic, and John Kennedy, following the discovery of the missile sites, had said, no, we will not allow these vessels to proceed to Cuba. We are placing Cuba in quarantine, and we will stop those vessels by our armed force if they come beyond a certain point. Now, Mr. Khrushchev, who was a rash, impulsive man, but not plumb out of his mind, wanted at this point to turn back his ships.
because he was understandably and properly afraid of war with the United States. And we ought to be glad of fear among statesmen. So he wanted to turn them back, but he didn't want to admit that he was backing down in front of the United States. In fact, he could hardly do it. He could hardly hold his job, or hope to hold his job, and do that. So he had to find a way out. And the way out was found very, very, very like the Suez operation, through the United Nations. Youth Thant, an underestimated gentleman, the then acting Secretary General of the United Nations. By the way, when I praise him like this, I'm doing so disinterestedly. He was one of the numerous people who, as our chairman has pointed out, more or less fired me. But I appreciate, nonetheless, his statesmanship. What he did was to address an appeal to both superpower heads. The appeal to the United States was to call off the quarantine, to end the quarantine, and that to Khrushchev to turn around the ships. Of course, it was the ships, not the quarantine, that was the basic problem. So Khrushchev, on receiving this appeal, immediately announced that the Soviet Union, faithful to the principles of the Charter and mindful of its commitment to the objectives of the UN and to world peace, was complying, immediately as Khrushchev spoke, was complying with the request of the Secretary General, and that Khrushchev then turned to the United States and appealed to them to show a similar spirit of commitment to the Charter and the world peace and so on, and call off the quarantine. And of course, it was quite easy to call off the quarantine when the ships were turned round. So Khrushchev had been enabled to save, exactly like Anthony Eden, as much face as was possible under the circumstances. And this combination of resources is very significant indeed, though it may sound a bit funny. I think it's a bit funny because human beings are a bit funny. If the United Nations, with these resources, did not exist, the world would be, I think, a considerably more dangerous place even than it is. If either superpower should ever take the deliberate decision to make war on the other, there is nothing the UN or anyone else could do about that. All would then be over for all of us, or almost all of us, and for our children. But it is almost inconceivable that either superpower should take such a decision, almost certainly involving its own destruction. What is much more likely, and very likely indeed, is that at one time or another, the superpowers, by miscalculation on one side or the other, or both, will be in danger of going over the brink and will be desperately anxious to avoid that, as all sane people would have to be. Those are the conditions in which the UN most certainly can help, and in the ways I have indicated. And that is why we need it for our survival. We should be patient with the follies often perpetrated within it, some of which are projections of our own collective follies. If indeed it were not so capable of expressing human folly, it could not perhaps be so fertile in resources for enabling humanity to escape from the worst consequences of particular follies of its rulers, as it must be enabled, for all our sakes, to continue to do. I thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your very kind and patient hearing. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, you will recognize we always have somewhat of a practical problem with an overflow audience, and the way we respond to that is we take our speaker to the other room, where thus far they've only seen and heard him on television, introduce him to that other audience, allow them to ask him one or two questions, which he will repeat before answering, because that will be heard by you in this room, at which point he will come back and be available for questions from this audience. Dr. Peter Jones, the secretary of the Vancouver Institute, will take our speaker to room 6.
Thank you.
Brian has graciously agreed to tackle two of your questions this evening. So,
first of all, I'd like to thank you very much for your warm reception just now. As I hadn't seen you, I thought you might be sitting in here glowering glumly and wondering how, when this was going to stop. Thank you very much. Yes, this gentleman. In our kind of country, in countries like this. Whether government PR efforts and propaganda efforts are likely to lead to a situation in which the media can be got to toe the line. There's always a bit of it. One thing that works a bit is the appeal to nationalism or patriotism. That works very, very, quite strongly. And of course, the government will try to make its own course of action identical with patriotism. For example, the American media supported the Vietnam War, most of them, for a considerable period after the judgment of most editors would have gone against it, but they felt we'd be unpatriotic if we did. But that applies, but in ordinary peacetime conditions, I think it would be very difficult for governments to get the media to toe the line, because if the media, if newspapers, for example, showed much signs of doing that, they would begin to lose the confidence of their readers, which is the one thing. Newspapers in our societies are much more afraid of their readers than they are of any government or indeed of anything. Yes, this lady back by the red. Sorry, yes, please, you. Yes.
I have three examples of times when I've been very upset with our Western media. One was at the time of the pre-Columbia, and I was only able to get the truth of the matter on the boat from Leningrad 1 year after this thing happened.
Thank you.
The lady who made those remarks was drawing attention to a number of failures of Western reporting of world events, including Greece, Egypt, and now the Hess case. There are certainly very, very considerable failures. It's rather a difficult matter when you're sitting in one society to be able adequately to cover the whole world. For one thing, you need to be able to situate a lot of background, and your readers may not be able to take in all that background. The reader must not be bored. That's the prime rule. And that, unfortunately, does limit things. The press has shown rather lamentable cases of blindness. I think myself that the most disgraceful is the failure of the press, including very good papers, to prepare the public for the tremendously important events which were preparing in Iran. That wasn't, of course, just a coup. It was a vast popular movement. And it should have been possible, and it was a great failure of the press not to give warning signs, listen, something is slipping there. Of course, one of the limiting factors is that Farsi, which is the language of Iran, is a language most people don't know, and the number of journalists who know it is quite small. And of course, the Shah knew, and his advisors knew, which journalists knew Farsi and did not. And they didn't let in the ones that would be likely to blow the gaff, and they did let in the ones that would be likely to keep up the Shah's charade. And those things happen, too. But there are, I agree with the lady who questioned, that there are considerable failures of the press, both in domestic and in foreign coverage. But still, there isn't any other kind of press there is any better. Now, I think I could take, I was told to take two. Can I take just one more? Yes, this gentleman here. Whether the government of democratic countries have a duty to attempt to raise the level of the press, particularly the level of the popular press, which, as the questioner points out quite rightly, is often lamentable. Well, I think the trouble about that is that if governments are usually thinking, we must hope that they are thinking about the welfare of the people and so on, but I have been a member of a government and I know that the pressure on a government to think about its own survival is very, very urgent. And naturally, tends to identify its own survival with the public good, which is an extremely convenient assumption, and one hopes that it's true. The danger there is that if the government were encouraged to set about trying to improve the press, what they would actually be likely to do is to try and make the press more amenable to government and to publicize those things which the government wanted publicized in the interests, of course, of the community as a whole, and to suppress those things which, however true and perhaps important, would be damaging to what government thought of as the national interest. And governments have tried that very, very often. The LBJ's government during the Vietnam War leant very hard on the government, on the press, to get it to be what he regarded as more responsible and better balanced. That is, more favorable to him. So those are the reasons why the press in the kind of country we have is refractory to the idea of government intervention, and that even the quality press, for example, such as my paper, The Observer, we would be opposed at any effort at government regulation of the press, even where we ourselves condemn the excesses of most of the press. Any attempt other than, of course, the application of ordinary laws of decency, libel, persecution, and what not. Those, we should try to apply those. Now, I wonder, ladies and gentlemen, would you forgive me if I return to the other one? You'll be able to see me on this thing.
Well, Dr. O'Brien is returning, ladies and gentlemen. Just let me remind you that next week's talk promises to be fascinating and exciting by Professor Markita Getz-Stankiewicz on the Czech theater. The fact that the title of her recent book was The Silenced Theater indicates a strong overlap between that subject next week and tonight's subject dealing with the problems of the press in non-free societies. Dr. O'Brien will be back momentarily. We would ask you to keep your questions short, to keep them questions, to keep them on the subject, which is not terribly restrictive given the ground Dr. O'Brien has covered. If you raise your hand, I'll recognize you.
I have a question regarding Dr. Conor Cruz O'Brien's recent tenure as editor-in-chief of The Observer. Now, it's not my intention here to deny the genius of Dr. O'Brien as a writer and as a scholar, but I do question his political observations. And I say this in the context of a recent, of a former staffer of his, Barry Holland, of the Observer magazine, where Dr. Conor Cruz O'Brien demanded and obtained very radical changes in an article for the Observer magazine, without giving Barry Holland the benefit of advising her, I believe, on those changes, the changes of Dr. Cruz. My question to Dr. O'Brien, why did this take place?
Well, I'm not sure how wide the interest is here in the question of what I did to a given contribution by a given member of the staff of my paper. What happened is the Observer magazine, as you know, is rather loosely connected with the paper, as is the case with most magazines attached to papers in the British system. I saw the editor of the magazine brought to my attention the magazine copy containing Ms. Holland's article on Northern Ireland at a very, very late stage, when it was too late for us to confer with it. Normally, I would always like to confer with a colleague. I thought the article was very, very bad, very, very misleading. I was very sorry indeed to have it appear in the magazine or in the paper at all. I told the editor so. It appeared that it was too late to stop the article altogether, which I would have wished to do, and which is within my power and ought to be within the power of an editor. That's what editors are for, to stop articles they don't believe are right, because they shouldn't give their readers information which they believe to be misleading. I wasn't able to stop it. I did secure, because the whole issue of the magazine would have had to be scrapped at that stage at great cost, and the management of the paper wouldn't have liked it, and the owners wouldn't have liked it, and so on. So the editor made some small changes on factual matters where she was wrong, and she objected to that, and I had some correspondence with her in which I tried to explain to her what was wrong. And that was it. But I mean, I think the principal concern is one of editorial control. Either an editor should determine, be responsible for what goes into his paper, allowing a good range of freedom to his trusted contributors, but he also should be able and should do his best to stop the publication of things which he believes to be misleading to his readers, or her readers, if it is the editor is a woman.
Yes. In the case of, say, the United States, a very bourgeois country, has a great interest in the free press. If you have no political control, but you have great financial control by the owners of the newspapers, and if you have a very strong Republican feeling amongst the owners,
Where owners of newspapers are generally of one political view in the United States, the Republican point of view, whether that doesn't tilt the press in the direction of a particular party. Yes, it does. And it's also true that in Britain, for example, the owners of newspapers mostly like the Tory party. But that does tilt opinion, if you like. But the extent to which it tilts it should not be, I think, overestimated. I think virtually the entire press of the United States was against Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But fortunately for him, the people were for him. The radio and television are still open to presidents and heads of opposition, very copiously open, and they can get through. The tilting, as I say, is there. Well, the news from Croydon, for example, doesn't suggest that the Tory owners of the British press have been able to have it all their own way. The tilt is there, but Anthony Wedgwood Benn, for example, has suggested what he would regard as reform measures and that. But the trouble is that to bring about government intervention in order to correct that tilt would be productive of consequences which are even more dangerous than the tilt itself. That's the problem. It's a catch-22.
Is the French press, with the allegations that it is heavily subsidized by government, does that not give you free press in your
mind? No. The case of France in terms of a free press and particularly of broadcasting is very marginal. The subsidies have affected it, though they haven't ever altogether stopped criticism. And some criticism from the French press goes further than we would, than our laws of libel, certainly in Britain, would permit. But broadcasting has been the great scandal, really, because broadcasting has been controlled by the government of the day. But again, I mean, even that, and I'm glad you brought up the French example, because it's very extreme. The tilt there is much greater than anything we have known. And yet, a president and a party which were in control of broadcasting and a part of the press for years and years was nonetheless defeated, and Mitterrand was elected contrary to all or most expectation. So again, the power of the press and broadcasting to affect political decisions can be very much exaggerated. It's not as great as is often supposed.
Two more questions here.
I'd like to, there are in Britain and in United States and in Canada, press councils. A group in BC have attempted to have a press council formed, made up of both professionals, that is those in the churches, and their lay citizens, and have been opposed and frustrated by the press, that is the daily press here. Yeah. What is your view of the role and value of these press councils in the community?
Well, either the press council has power or it has not. If the press council has power, you are getting, as the press council has really to be appointed by governments, you're getting near the idea of governmental control of the press, which, as I've suggested, is undesirable. If the press council is purely advisory, as is the case in Britain, I can only speak with experience of the British example. There may be better ones elsewhere. The British one does not enjoy any respect from the profession. If it slaps a paper over the wrist, nobody is impressed, neither the paper nor the public nor anybody. And if it fails to slap a paper over the wrist, you simply look at its composition on that particular day and notice that the editor of the paper in question was on it and wouldn't slap himself over the wrist. So it's not by any means an impressive body, and not, I'm afraid, even taken seriously by the journalistic profession.
Sir Brian, could you tell us the countries that are aligned with the UNESCO position to begin to sort of throttle the press in the West? Do they have any power to bring to bear on this? Do they actually have means by which they can bring this about?
Yes, the extent of the power wielded by those who are behind the UNESCO drive. First of all, the UNESCO drive for international regulation of the press has been a largely impalpable thing. It's very hard to bring anything concrete out of this debate. It's curiously woolly. But they do have leverage, yes. They have leverage in the sense that they can deny access to their countries, and their countries together cover most of the globe, to journalists or to international news agencies and wire services, if they want to do that. And they have been able to exert fairly formidable collective pressure on the wire services. The wire services are extremely careful what they report from the Third World. And they, unless the news is devastatingly important, they will think two or three times before they report events from an important Third World country, let's say Nigeria, which the government of that country would not like to see. Because Reuters or the Associated Press or United Press or whoever don't want to be thrown out of Nigeria. That's the leverage behind it. But the effort to produce resolutions about what's called free and balanced flow of news, this is the, as I think, the poisoned language used, or balanced, responsible coverage. Responsible is an important word. Responsible to whom? Governments mean responsible to governments. That all this language has a kind of role. And the people who are most endangered by that are not the journalists of the Western world. They are journalists in these dicey situations where the press is partly free and partly not, and the editor has to wonder every day, will I get away with that story we carried on page 3, or are they going to come and take me away? Now, there, if you take an obvious case here, is the government of India. The government of India has, by tradition, for many years, been given to high-minded declarations on points of morality. Most governments are so inclined, but the Indian government takes the record in most instances. Now, therefore, the Indian government, like most Third World countries, yearns to control the press. But it would like to do so and feel good at the same time. Now, the stuff that is pumped out by UNESCO is very suited to that end. So that if Mrs. Gandhi tells the Times of India You must exercise more responsibility in your journalism. You're absolutely free to comment, but your comment must be balanced, and your choice of news must be responsible, and it must be balanced. And all these things are laid down in UNESCO regulations, so and so, which India, unlike other less moral countries, regards as binding, and therefore.